Hi, Guillen.
Hi. So yeah, at some point you said that the decay of the Z boson proves that there are three species of neutrino.
Yes.
But this does not exclude very massive neutrinos that could be heavier than the...
Yes,
that's so
not excluded.
If they are included, what happens? Like, does this change the oscillations? Or?
Well, I mean, it will have to be considerably... So you would have to have like a fourth generation in which the neutrino, for some reason, is much heavier than any of the other generations. So all the particles, by the way, would have to be heavier than whatever we have observed, right? So, yeah, I mean, there are other reasons why you may have constraints on fourth generations associated with the Higgs width, right? But in principle, from the point of view of neutrino physics, if you have a very heavy state and it makes very little, then it will have a very little effect. On the, okay, so somehow your 3x3 matrix will not be exactly unitary, but at the level of which we have measured the unitarity of that matrix, in principle, that is not that is still, so some unitarity violations of the order of percent are allowed. So eventually you will have that. That will be probably the main effect for neutrinos. Okay, but yeah, that. But when we say that there are only three, is that there are all these, right? By the way, they will have to be heavy, and then that means they will have to be given a mass. So that means that you will have new physics. So it's not just a replica of that. You will have to be able to give a mass that is as heavier than any other particles, and then that you have to explain why that it is. Okay. So yes, a fourth generation would, but it is somehow not favored at the moment. Yes.
Hi, this is Daniel from Hungary. So you briefly mentioned the mass limit given by the Katrin experiment. My question is, as far as I know, there were like many upgrades to the experiment recently, and is this...
This is the latest.
This is the latest
result. This is the result they published in 2021.
Oh, perfect. And any more like upgrades expected from them?
Okay, so when they come, I think their ultimate sensitivity, I think it was written in the slide, is of the order of 0.3 electron volt. So that's when they will finish if they get to their expected sensitivity. Yes, that's about it.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. All right. Yep. Yeah, you?
Hi, I'm Christian. My question is...
Sorry, what is your name? Excuse me.
Christian.
Oh, okay.
Is it always necessary to have the mass difference for oscillations, or can I have in non-standard interactions or something like that also?
Yeah,
oscillations.
As I said, all right, so let me go here. Why don't we turn this off already?
Oh, Christine, what's this?
You don't know how to turn this off anymore. Okay, that's what happens when you have never seen a slide. All right, so, okay, let me go somewhere here. Okay, there we go. I stop this again. Okay, oh, I have to go all these slides. Here. Okay, so I'm trying to get very far. I'm getting there, okay. So this is what I tried to do. That's what I very quickly mentioned this morning. So when we started looking at this effect, what we are really seeing from the point of view of physics as a time is flavor transition, okay? So you are seeing that there is some physics that it is not aligned with the flavor of the interactions. So many forms of new physics that are flavor dependent will give you that interference effect. And I list here as selections of those. Okay, so this is a possibility, right, as a theoretical point. The question is that does this fit the data? So what is the main observable that will be able to distinguish these mechanisms from the standard mass oscillations is the energy dependence of the oscillation wavelength. The mass wavelength goes as, you know, the oscillation length depends as energy like that. In this other mechanism, it depends with different powers. Sometimes it's independent. For example, for non-standard, if you had a totally only had the matter effects, then you would, with new physics, you would have wavelength that is independent of the energy, or if you have some other funds like violation of Lorentz invariance, they will have an inverse dependence with it. So that will have different powers. Now, atmospheric neutrinos are extremely powerful to test this because we have observed the flavor of these neutrinos in a very, very wide range of energies. So we can really look at the dependence. And that is what I was trying to show you here. If you go to these very high energy ones in which the delta M squared driven oscillations had already dead because I'm too high in energy, all these other mechanisms that pop up with energy should show up. And they don't. All right? So even if I put them if I put delta M squared oscillation plus a little bit of that, it's already pretty much disfavored by data, and that is why I can put all these strong constraints on these mechanisms. Yeah.
So that's the answer. So basically it was required to have this information additionally, so that, for the Nobel Prize 2015, they basically said from the oscillation, then we know that there is neutrino mass, but you also need this information.
Yes, you need to make sure, so you have, okay, so that is one of the jobs that we had to do at the very beginning was to make sure that what we were observing were mass-driven oscillations. As I say, neutrino, as I say, flavor oscillations does not mean mass. Flavor oscillation means I have a misalignment in the propagation. Which is the mechanism for the misalignment? I have to work at it. But already at the time of that, already with the very first data from the atmospheric neutrinos, I'm talking about, well, soon after the 1998, it was clear that if I try to fit this data with any power of E, we'd make that fit, I had some figure somewhere, you could very well see that it had to be N equal to minus one or one, depending on how you define it, right? But it had to be really mass driven. Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah.
My name is Luigi from Munich. So as far as I understood along the lines, you may be a little bit skeptical about this foreseeing combination of NOVA and T2K data for trying to understand something more about the delta CP. So is it, if this is the case, if this is what you think, why?
No.
Wouldn't
okay.
Please. Yes.
No. Okay. So I'm not a skeptical. I'm just saying that it is a okay. So I'm just saying that the time scale of this is the ideal. Okay. Ideal is that you have these two experiments and you want to sit together and they analyze and they will do it and they are doing it. I'm just saying that I have heard this, that they are working on this already for quite a few years. So it's not skeptical on the fact that it's important. It's not skeptical on the fact that they are doing it. It's skeptical maybe on the time scale of the output. And the actual, each experiment wants to claim something, right? So how much are they going to put? So right now, each of them have analyzed a certain amount of data, and they have more data, okay, each of them. But I'm not sure in this combined analysis, they will put all the data that they have not published individually by themselves. That is my statement. But
in principle, do you expect from such a combination, let's say, complicated combination, to have something more clear and more stringent than what phenomenologists like you?
All right. Yes, obviously, because I cannot. Okay. So clearly, they know their experiments much better. So there are effects that I cannot foresee, like some of the ones that Sandro was commenting.
Okay.
So yeah, I'm looking forward for the result of their analysis, right?
Okay, thanks. And then, so connected to this, I have another question. So as a phenomenologist doing this sort of global analysis, what do you expect experimentalists to give you in terms of material? I mean, usually? I guess it's a delicate voice.
No. I mean, as I said, so what would I like them to give me first? I would like them to give me the data in the same format that they use for their analysis, which sometimes doesn't happen. Okay, they give you the data in a binning, which is not the one they are using. So the way a phenomenologist does an analysis, all these things, is what do I do? They have done a partial analysis of their data. The first thing I do is I try to tune my analysis, my phenomenological analysis. I have to tune some things to be able to reproduce in the limits of the analysis, right? They may do some what they get, the regions they get, the parameters they get. Then once I have somehow this template, then I can do whatever, then I can incorporate it, right? But it's very difficult to do this thing if they don't give you enough information, okay? So the very basic is please give me the data in the same form. Give me all the data that you are using in the format that you are using.
Okay, so Reddit is just far more advanced than doing something like I just give you the likelihood. So till you
no,
have
no. If they give me the likelihood, then I'm not doing anything.
Right.
Okay, that's what the atmospheric neutrinos gave me. Okay, so I can sum the chi-square between right. anybody can sum a table, right? But that's actually what is very much done in cosmology when the observables are so complicated. But then you are not testing anything, right?
Right.
And second, once I have my own function of chi-square, I can analyze the data for other scenarios. You give me a chi-square for a given framework. I'm interested in using my analysis to test any other framework. Right? So I just, you know, it is a phenomenologist. You know, you want to have your own,
yeah.
You know.
On the other side, I think it's very complicated for a big experiment with a lot of data to outsource their data in
yeah,
an easy
I
way.
Yeah, I totally understand that. So I'm just, there's
nothing. My question is whether you're aware of any, let's say, external effort for making this simpler, maybe in the future or
my personal experience is that things are going in the opposite direction and making it every time tougher instead of difficult. Like, I'm sorry to say, but the experiments used to put theses of the students in which
right.
at least the data, I could find it in the thesis.
Right.
For the last years, not even in the thesis you find the thesis. The thesis is showing an analysis and the data they are showing the analysis of is not included in the thesis. Okay, and I'm not going to be, you know, having persecution, complex. But you start wondering, right? Why would they do
something
like that?
Perfectly know the dynamics and.
Yeah. So I just I don't know because at the end of the day, this is public money, all right?
Right.
So
right.
I don't know. Okay. So
right,
that is.
Right.
Okay.
No,
I
think it's a very complicated.
Sometimes I feel
discussion.
Like I am, as
yes.
I say, I used to say. Like
but thanks for sharing your opinions.
That was more sociological than physics, yes. Okay.
Hi there, I'm Eric. So I saw you talk a little bit about like hints of sterile neutrinos, like three plus one models.
Yes.
And to me, like, I don't know, in my mind, I don't really like these three plus one models. It's not very elegant to me. So is there any hints of like these like neutrino minimal standard models, the ones where like each neutrino has their own the sterile antiparticle. Are there any hints to like these kinds of models?
All right. So you have to understand what we talk when we talk about this. So right-handed neutrinos, you can add as many as you want. You could add three of them,
right.
Pair them perfectly with the three light, and then you make three Dirac neutrinos, and you will have three light neutrinos which are Dirac. And from the point of view of the phenomenology, you will not, you know, you will just have some three light neutrinos, and everything that I told you is exactly the same. All right. So when we talked about light sterile neutrinos, we mean some additional, so we put right-handed, but they are with a different, there is an additional mass state. Okay? So they are not, you cannot pair it with another left and make a Dirac. Okay? Mm-hmm. So that is what we call a light. And yes, I share with you, these are not particularly elegant because you have to find somehow, from the point of view of an ultraviolet completion, something that stabilizes a singlet of the standard model to be very light. That is not the most elegant thing. But if data tells you you need them, then somebody will figure out the elegance of it. So my point was that even from the point of view of the data, these are not very much supported at the moment. That is my point. All right. That you can fit them, but you had all these anomalies, and even the ones that have survived cannot be well described with this, all of them. So, if there are light sterile neutrinos, you need something beyond light stellar neutrinos. So that people talk about light stellar neutrinos and neutrino decay. Light stellar neutrino and strange way of the coherence. So it's so if three plus one is not elegant, 3 plus 1 and something that works is probably even less elegant. But I am totally okay with lack of elegance if the data tells me so. My personal position is that I don't find the data compelling enough. There are anomalies. There are things we don't understand. And yes, let's keep thinking about it. Stellar neutrinos are not the answer, trivially, though, for that.
All right, sounds good. Thanks.
Yeah. Okay. Yes.
Hi, my name is Aidan from KU Leuven. And I was hoping to ask a little bit about extragalactic neutrinos, which I don't think we talked too much about this in the presentation.
No, because there is Francis Halsen coming next week. He will tell you a lot about them, okay?
Maybe then just as a preview, I could ask two quick questions. What are the sources of these extragalactic neutrinos?
Yeah, right, so
what sorts of questions do we access by studying them?
Okay, so the main question that astrophysicists studying, I mean, the high energy from the point of view of an external first member, you want to know where the high energy cosmic rays come from, right? The high energy cosmic rays are mainly protons, okay, protons or some nuclei that hit the atmosphere, and they come with an energy, you know, that are humongous. So where are these? What are the sources of acceleration for this? And then there are some, proposals of people who study the sources. And if they are generated, these are protons, right? So these are hadrons. And whatever that, and there are also very high energy gamma rays. So if you think about it, that your accelerator is going to produce where the gamma rays will come, they will come from pions. If you have also proton something, will produce pion, neutral pions. There will be also charged pions being produced. So if you have some kind of hadronic reactions in the source, whatever the source is, that will give you these high energy cosmic and high energy photons, that same source would also give you high energy neutrinos. And the difference is that these high energy neutrinos do not get deflected by magnetic fields or whatever. So they point. So that is the poor woman's explanation of the need of multi-messenger astronomy. And at the moment, with the data, they have some candidates of the type of sources, but Francis will tell you much more about it than I can tell you. Okay, but that is somehow the main motivation.
So, in the back, Avanish from Nikkev. So, following up on... Basdo Sharma. It's quite complicated. All right.
We need to know it's the family name. That's important.
Yeah.
Not the first name, okay? Sorry for interrupting.
All right, Basdo Sharma. With a slash between the Basdo and Sharma. All right, so following up on Eric, and you talked about the UV completion of the effective terms which will describe new physics. So out of pure curiosity, are all these, or the terms you're considering in the Lagrangian effective ones, are they renormalizable?
About them as some kind of low energy effect of something that eventually you will need to build a ultraviolet completion for that. That is the way you think about them. All right? So no, in principle, they are not as a low energy. It's like higher dimension operators are not renormalizable, right?
Right.
But you always think about them as low energy effects of something that will be renormalizable once you put the full theory.
All right. So you hope they will be renormalizable, yes. In the UV.
Yes, yes. That's the way you think about
okay.
them. Yeah. But the neutrinos are all very low energy from that point of view, all right?
Yeah, okay.
Okay. Vladislav Barinov from Moscow. Thank you. And there are recent results about BEST experiment and neutrino for experiment. And the results of these experiments have some strong tension with the results as the experiment, for example, Debye, Prospect, and T2K for neon detector. If you know, I mean all the results 2014 year. And what do you think about this tension, and what's the problem in your opinion? Maybe cross-section and extraction procedure, and what do you think? Thank
okay.
you.
So first, this is, I've not worked on this for a long time. So the new result from BES, basically, my understanding is that they at least from the point of view of the rate, is that they somehow reinforce this gallium deficit, this gallium, this what is called this gallium anomaly, and then reinforce it. So it's a confirmation that there is something there that we do not understand. As the problem is that to make the simple interpretation of some oscillations at short baseline is in conflict with many other experiments. So it has to be something else. Cross sections is the obvious thing to think about it, but they have been tested, all right? So it's not clear. At some moment we check, you know, because these cross sections, at least the calculations, are relatively well known. So we played a little bit with removing some of the possible contributions of some excited states, if I remember that I'm talking about when the beginning of the anomaly, and it was not obvious that this was possible. So no, the answer is I don't think nobody has a very good explanation for that. Okay, that is an open question of the long baseline. Now, concerning neutrino 4 and the other, we are here. These are distortions. Okay, these are observation of this thing that I say, these wiggles. Now, and in this again, I'm quoting the analysis that you can find all the details you want in this paper. These people have said, you have all these wiggles, now how statistically significant are these wiggles? And the thing is that you cannot use your simple chi-square distributed probability function because it doesn't work. These people did a Monte Carlo simulation in which to extract the probability distribution of this data. All right? And what they found is that this data that looks wiggling really doesn't wiggle that much when you are really putting about it. So this data meaning is perfectly fittable with almost a flat. Okay? If it means the actual statement that they made is that the Monte Carlo estimation of the probability distribution of all these experiments, including the neutrino 4, shows no significant indication of these oscillations, which is basically saying that these wiggles are really don't show a much better fit than a straight line. Once you put really this, when you estimate this this probability distribution without assuming Gaussianity, if you want.
I want to say about neutrino 4. If you know Carla Giunti article, so-called oscillation or fluctuation, and estimate significant of the neutrino 4 experiment, and from three standard values from 2.2.
Yes.
And statistics is so.
Yeah. So I'm just saying that
yeah.
when you do it, even with your, because Carlo is still assuming, I think, Wilk's theorem, if you really do it this with the Monte Carlo, it goes even lower than that. It goes to 1.something sigma.
Yeah. Thank you.
That is my understanding of this paper, but I give you the reference just if you want to read it, okay?
Just very quickly to follow up on this. It's a very quick one. I'm Luigi again. So do you know exactly what's the Wilk's theorem condition that is not verified in this situation?
I should read the paper because it's not my work, and I read it diagonally to be able to really make this statement, and I am one question deep on this
no
one.
No problem.
Okay, sorry. Yes.
Aniello? So you mentioned dark photons before,
yes.
Speaking about non-standard interactions.
Yes.
So my question is, do you expect at some point to be able to distinguish among various models of dark interactions.
Okay, so I will need a signal. Yeah. Okay, so as of now, we only put bounds because there is not a clear signal that that points out in that direction. So the truth of the matter is that what we have, again, is the fact that we can fit everything with my standard neutrinos and my standard matter effect.
Okay.
So as far as I can do that, I cannot distinguish between all the things that I'm not fitting. Right, that is the fact. But
Thank you.
Yeah, sorry. It's the life. Yes. Yeah, you.
So for these stereo neutrino anomalies, the for non-mass square splitting explanations, like I have heard of like neutrino decay or decorrelation a few times, but I have not heard these equivalence principle violation and Lorentz violation being rediscussed in this context.
No, I think they are too strongly constrained to be actually able to do that. People discuss the coherence, which is right. It's not totally orthogonal to that decays, but I haven't really seen because you need something that really I think you lose. You know, all these additional scenarios that I discussed in right, violation of blah blah. These are all unitary at the end of the day. Right, and I think decay, the coherent, they are not unitary, right? So I think that's probably that even if they were not so constrained, I'm not sure they will help you. But I cannot, as I say, I haven't tried.
Okay, Anastasia Omeluch from Bochum. If neutrinos are Dirac particles, can they theoretically oscillate to antineutrinos? So say muon neutrino oscillation to muon antineutrino.
Muon neutrino to antineutrino, you cannot, I mean, that violates, I don't know, a lot of things, CPD probably. So I don't think, whether Dirac or Majorana or whatever, right, that is not, that I don't think that is a possibility. But no, I don't think. So maybe you have something to say about it?
Well, you say neutrino, mu neutrino to antineutrino oscillation would violate some many principles. True, but not doesn't violate logic. In principle, the neutrino muon could oscillate into the antimuon. It would violate.
Well, I mean,
Feynman,
the original proposal.
It would violate.
Yes, but it violates. Yes.
It would violate lepton number conservation.
Yes. Yes.
Eventually, we believe that all global symmetries might be violated at some point, but it would be an extremely rare
but
process
I don't think,
for sure.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, but in any case, it's whether I don't know whether they could be Dirac. So that's totally not the case.
Well, the name Dirac would then be a false name. Yeah. But they say only it's false one in 10 to the so many universes, then it's all right.
Yeah, okay.
You can call it a Dirac particle under ordinary circumstances, but it violates the Dirac equation in a very rare set of circumstances. That can always happen.
Okay. Okay. On this note, yes. You had a question? Somebody had a question? Somebody wants to go? No? Everybody has. Yeah, you still have a question? More questions? The guy. You.
Can I go ahead?
I'll start by you because you.
Okay.
The one you.
Luigi.
I don't remember your name. Your name.
Luigi
from Germany. Even if you are called Luigi, yes, tell me.
I'm Italian, actually.
Really?
Okay. Just to follow up on what we discussed earlier about relation between cross sections and these excesses,
yes.
I think, and correct me if I am wrong, like Minibund, for example, does not have any near detector, right? So it's just at one single detector and a beam line and measures this excess. But I also do think that there is some some point published some cross-section measurement. Is that true, or am I?
Well, you have this Minerva and all these other experiments, yeah, which are dedicated to measure these cross-sections. Okay? So they try to, and Micro Boone, after all, was also dedicated to measure these fluxes. So some subsets, they see this excess, and up to the level of what it has been tested in other experiments, they cannot explain these excesses on an obvious way of cross-sections. That is my understanding.
Okay, but there's no experiment that is claiming an excess and at the same time measuring a cross-section. I'm wrong, right? That,
well, you cannot, I don't think how you could, I mean.
Doesn't make any sense, right?
No,
so
no,
that
yeah.
just means.
You measure,
like
you measure an excess, but I mean, but you are using the information from all other
Thanks.
Measurements, okay? That is, yes?
So Miniboon does publish a lot of cross-section papers, and many experiments use them, but it's mostly muon neutrino cross-section,
yes.
And the excess is seen in electron neutrinos.
Yeah, yeah.
And Micro Boone recently, what is it, in the context of these confirmations?
Yes, that is. These are the results from Micro Boone.
Yeah, and they either already did or will publish electron neutrino related cross sections,
yes,
as a, like for example, one plausible background hypothesis were processes where you have a neutral current interaction with a photon that looks like an electron and mini boone, and so they published.
Yeah.
I think
so this is the result from the last Micro Boone experiment in which they have actually measured these event rates in this different, okay, and this is these red lines, as I say, is using their own interpretation of what they would expect if what Mini Boone has observed was an electron neutrino. That is what they should be observing. And that is not what they have observed. So that's why they say in their own paper, this is a Micro Boone result, they claim that they do not support that the observation of Mini Boone is electron neutrinos. But it's not that they have some better idea of what it is. Okay? So we are okay. So people claim that they still, it's really not that they are ruled out, maybe some, okay. That is an open question. But, yeah, we don't. Yes.
My name is Anna Fogel. Can I ask a question about supernova neutrinos?
So you can ask a question whether I can answer. I don't know.
No, because we didn't talk much about this, but if we made another observation detection in the future, which oscillation parameter would we expect to prove if we measured supernova neutrinos? Or is the mass measurement would be precise enough to be compact?
It's a long time that I don't work on this. Supernova neutrinos used to be very very sensitive when you had high delta M squared, like the sterile type of scenarios were strongly constrained on that. In the framework of three neutrino oscillations, I don't know how much they have to add. To be totally honest, okay, I don't, but I haven't followed. You could have asked this to the following speaker if he ever shows up, because I think he's probably more of an expert
of
that. All right, but I cannot help you. I'm sorry.
Thanks.
It's a while. It's a long time that I don't work on supernova neutrinos. So, yes.
Yeah. So, name's Aidan again. I actually had a specific question about some of the things, about a couple of expressions you had in your slides, when you wrote down some of the mixing matrices. Now, in particular, in some of these matrices, there's a mismatch between the number of flavor states and the number of mass states.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
And.
Okay, I'm going under. It's better if I do it like this.
Let's see.
There you have it.
Yeah. Right. And so I guess my question was, like, is there anything that says that there has to be the same number of mass states as flavor states, or can there be a mismatch between these numbers?
No. Okay.
In general,
so as I say, we know that we have three left neutrinos, right? A, mu, and tau. And then right-handed neutrinos are free, right? They are singlets of the standard model. Put as many as you want. So this is the most general form of the Lagrangian that I can write. So once I diagonalize it into the mass base, that's where I am. There's nothing, right? So the only, as I said, that's why this is, if you think in the case of the quarks, you have three left and three right, because that's what you need to build the electromagnetic current, and you cannot have more left than right, all right? But neutrinos, you can have more right-handed neutrinos than left-handed neutrinos. You can have a different number. So that is at the end why this mixing matrix doesn't have to be a square. So when we are talking about, in fact, sterile neutrinos, the leptonic mixing matrix in the case of 4 plus 1 is 3 times 4. It's 3, because the E mu tau, okay? Leptonic mixing matrix is always flavor times mass, all right? So you have 3 times as many massive as you want. It's the most general case, right? And then, of course, you know, depending on the dimensions, you have a different number of parameters in the matrix. Okay, that is. Okay, so so the common law. Then, if you were to go to the grand unified theory, and then you would have your three right-handed neutrinos. Okay, that will be for each generation. You know, in SO10, you have a right-handed neutrino that it belongs to the representation in which all the standard model particles fit. The thing is that in that type of context, you could write the most general Lagrangian for the neutrinos, you would have a Majorana mass for these right-handed neutrinos. And that Majorana mass for the right-handed neutrinos would have nothing to do with electroweak symmetry breaking. It's a bare mass that will come from the SO10 breaking. Those are the generic scenario that will give you an extremely very heavy right-handed neutrinos. You take that right-handed neutrino, you integrate it out from your low energy spectrum, and you end up with 3 light Majorana very close to purely left-handed neutrinos. That is the lore that's called the standard, that is called the CISO mechanism, and that is the standard mechanism that will give you very light neutrinos and a very heavy, almost purely right-handed neutrinos. At the unification scale, that is somehow okay. That is clearly new physics, but it's at a scale that is really high. But yeah, so everything. So this. So that is okay. That will, yes.
Hi, this is Daniel Kincses from Hungary once again here. So I have a question related to the Gold-Haber experiment that you mentioned.
Yeah.
So you said that they concluded that the helicity is -1, right? And I'm just interested in what was the like their uncertainty on this measurement.
Because I say it's one page, you can read it.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a paper that you can read from home, even if it's in Physical Review D, because it was liberated, so it is free. You don't have to pay for it, all right? So I don't remember, but it is, I do have it in my computer, but I don't remember that. So they have to have some kind of, obviously, smearing of that, okay? So they have an statement. I'm not sure they quantified in terms of an uncertainty at the time, right? But it was compatible, yeah. Yes.
Are there any more, like, recent helicity measurements?
But maybe, I have no idea. I mean, as I say, since we know that it is, I mean, everything that we have observed, okay, the current is compatible with having helicity -1, pure helicity -1, yes. So that is
okay, that. Thank you.
Left-handed neutrinos.
So, Avanish Bhaskar Sharma from NICEF, following up on that, in general, in the neutrino business, how do the experimental and observational uncertainties compare against the uncertainties from theoretical predictions?
In the neutrino business, there are, there are efforts to match the theoretical uncertainties with the experimental uncertainties and vice versa. Is that the question?
No. How do the uncertainties in experiments compare against the uncertainties from theoretical predictions?
So, depend on the observable we are talking about. Right? So what observable are we talking about? For cross-sections, we have, if there's nuclear cross-sections are still pretty uncertain from the theoretical point of view in many cases. So that is from the theoretical point of view, there is no prediction. I cannot predict the mass. So I mean, I don't know what is.
So you would say experiment here is leading.
This is an experimentally driven field.
Yeah.
All right. So the only thing that we do from the point of view, I don't, but can be done with these results, once you transform them into parameters of a Lagrangian, is from the point of view of learning about theory, is the top-down approach. Mm-hmm. People write models for flavor, round them down, compare them to data, and then they can tell you something about. So that is the type of effort. Okay. So, for example, this θ13 measurement comes out to be 8 degrees. Everybody thought that it was going to be much smaller. There were trillions of models in which it was predicted to be incredibly small, right? That you measure is larger, and then you take all these models and you have to throw them away, or you have to improve on the modeling of the flavor. But the truth of the matter is that we do not have a theory for flavor in the standard model, neither for the quarks. Right? We have three generations, as you said, we don't know why we have three generations. The structure of the Yukawas, we have parameterized these flavor effects in the structure of Yukawa matrices, which we cannot predict. They are one of the whatever number of inputs that we just have to measure. Okay. So the efforts are mostly on that, to try to measure as precisely as possible to constrain the possible flavor ideas on how to to explain relation between these parameters. Basically, is what you search at the end of the day. Maybe people claim because these delta m squares were so different, then this mixing angle has to be extremely small because in many scenarios they are correlated. Well, data doesn't tell you that. It tells you how you have to think differently. Nobody has killed themselves because their model was not proven. So. Okay. There's always another model.
Good, thank you.
Yes.
This is Anthony.
Anthony.
And you mentioned that the CKM and lepton mixing matrices are much different.
Yes.
And you also mentioned that there are a lot of efforts at trying to understand why. Do you have examples of frameworks or theoretical models?
Not in the slides. I mean, we can talk. Okay, so people have. I mean, this belongs to the to this. As I say, neutrino physics has many different activities. One of them is model building. So people look for symmetries, discrete symmetries that maybe can help to understand. Or like they would say clearly they are not. If in this grand unified type of schemes. Clearly the rotation matrices of the quarks and of the leptons should be related. So if they are so different, it's clearly because the right-handed part of the neutrinos, the heavy part, should play a role that is more important. So this type of models, but I'm not, and this is not my work, so I cannot tell you more about it. Right, I'm sorry.
But for instance, this is something that is addressed by grand unified theories.
So people try to put this in the framework of grand unified theories. The more and more these things become very different, the more and more difficult it is to put this in a very minimalistic form in the framework of grand unified theories. But there are still constructions in the framework of grand unified theories that seem to be able to explain this scheme. Or accommodate, I wouldn't say explain, I would say accommodate. Okay. Yeah?
In neutrino oscillation experimental landscape, do you think that measuring precisely oscillation parameters only is a priority compared to other things?
Okay, so. Let me say, I don't take myself seriously enough to give you an answer that you should really take very seriously, but I'm going to tell you my opinion as a scientist, but please, I'm not as an expert. I would say that if you tell me what I would like to see, I would like to see neutrinos double beta decay clarified. I think that to know that neutrinos are a Majorana particle, a positive signal, right? That will be fantastic. To have direct measurement of the mass, okay? In a model independent way, so I want to see it, a kinematic effect, don't tell me about cosmology, sorry, okay? Wait, even if I love cosmology, I've done 1,000 feet of cosmological masses, there is always a model dependence on that. So, so give me those two, and then just keep, but then of course, UNCP violation, and that is where you have to deal with oscillation. There is nothing else you can do, right? So that those are my three wishes. All right, that is probably what I would like. That okay. But I'm not. Sorry. Sandro, do you agree?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. I think we have been. I don't know if I have been half a lot of time up here.
Maybe then I have also another question.
Yes.
So in this global fix you are doing, what are you currently working on? What are the next steps?
This is my life, all right? So there are new experimental results, and then you just have to incorporate them, you have to understand them, and you have to. So that is the bread and butter type of thing. It's all bread and butter. It's not trivial, okay? It's not bread and butter in the sense that, you know, I wake up in the morning and I just, no. It's a pain in the whatever you want to put it, because sometimes you have to persecute to get all the information and to make sure that you want to do it consistently. That is one thing. Then the other thing is we could do is try to understand these anomalies with extended scenarios. So that is the type of things that you do. You try to see if you can construct, like, for example, we have been people talking about the effects on non-standard interactions, right? So you put these non-standard interactions, and then you say, well, can I build model? Can I find some really a scenario? For example, the Z primes and light mediators was a way of showing that, yes, there are still room in the oscillation neutrino data to see effects that have not been ruled out in other experiments, for example. That is, so this is the type of effort that goes into this global. So the three neutrino oscillation is a service to the community that we do and publish every now and then. And I think that everybody who does this analysis feels about like that. It's a lot of work, right? And you get a lot of citations for the numbers, but at the end of the day, it's from the point of view of, you always have to learn new physics for the understanding the experiments. But the main thing is that you now have this tool that allows you to address other questions, like for the solar neutrinos. We decided, okay, so what can I learn about the solar fluxes? Can I actually, for example, one thing that I worried about is that the solar model works forward, right? You put some inputs that you read the abundances of the elements in the sun and for the composition and blah, blah. You run this code and then you get some outputs. Among the outputs that you get are the neutrino fluxes. You also get outputs about heliocosmology, so how this pulsate. Fine. So there are problems with this, in the fact that there are, in principle, two generations of models depending on which type of abundances you use. So that measurements of abundances as input. And one of them is a more modern abundances, but gives me a pulsation that doesn't work very well. The other, okay, so you would like to be, so one thing that we say is that neutrinos, fluxes in principle can distinguish these two things. They are slightly different in these two models. And at some moment, I would like to see if I'm able to use the information of neutrinos in the modeling of the sun. So that's something, for example, we decided to do. Can I actually make an inverse problem of actually using this information? At the moment, the precision is not that great, but we developed the methodology to what is called feedbackwards. Okay? So this is the type of thing that you do once you have a numerical tool, if you want, that it is tuned to the data. That is the type of things. Okay.
Any other questions? Well, let's thank the speaker. This is to say that Concha has beaten all records of RHA. She has the longest question session since the last 20 years or something. So she should get a prize. I don't know what.
But I know. Well, I'm
having
some of
okay. Okay, so Professor Kosho. Yes, where is he? He's not there.
Okay, so that means that you change the schedule, right? So maybe you can send that the students
when people are okay, then it's easy. Then we start now with the students. Yes.
La, okay. So, like this one. No, it is fine, okay? Okay, so, when can I start? Now? Yeah? Okay, so, hi everyone, I'm Anna Maria Hall, I come from LMU, and first of all, I would like to thank you all for giving me the opportunity to speak a little bit about my work. So, today we are gonna be speaking, let me just do this. So today we are going to be speaking a little bit about dualities. So let us start with what is called the principle of continuity. So in 1955, Schrödinger and Bass imposed this principle. So they basically say that if I take a theory and I modify it a little bit by adding its small parameter, for instance, mass, okay, by hand, then if I take this mass or parameter back to zero, then all of the observable effects should match with those of the original theory, okay? And now, okay, this seems pretty legit. However, it does not always seem to be the case. For instance, we can take massive Young-Mills theory. So, over here, this is the standard kinetic term. And now over here, you added a mass term by hand. And over here is the vector boson. Now, if you take just this theory, then it seems that if you now do the standard perturbation theory, that it violates unitarity. Okay? Very good. And also, moreover, it seems not to be power counting renormalizable. Okay, so this is the first example where we have some kind of problems. Now we can go on. And now we go, for instance, to linearized massive gravity. Now, in this case, in fact, so if you take just write down the Lagrangian of the linearized massive graviton, then it seems that the prediction of such theory do not match with those of general relativity to such an extent that you can completely exclude this theory as a possible theory of nature. Now, this was actually shown in 1970 by Van Damme, Veltman, and Zakharov, and also Ipasaki, actually. However, this is in fact not what happens. Now, only 2 years later, came Weinstein and said the following. So, massive gravity is a nonlinear theory, okay? So this means that at some point you will have a certain scale at which the nonlinear terms actually become of the same order as the linear terms. Okay? And once this happens, the perturbation theory breaks down. Now, why did the perturbation theory was problematic in the first place? Well, this was because of the existence of the extra degree of freedom, the longitudinal mode. Okay? Because if you take, for instance, massive gravity, then it has 5 degrees of freedom, where, for instance, just linearized gravity has 2. Similarly, in massive Young-Mills theory, if you add the mass term by hand, then you have 3 degrees of freedom, 1 longitudinal mode and 2 transverse ones, where just massless one has two transverse degrees of freedom, per color, of course. Okay? So now, what happens then in gravity? So you basically have a certain scale, which is called the Weinstein radius. So I brought it over here. Okay? And so this is basically the scale where your perturbation theory breaks down. The nonlinear terms are of the same order as the linear terms for the longitudinal modes. So in other words, the longitudinal mode enters a strong coupling regime. And then basically, if you are on the scales which are smaller than this Weinstein radius over here, then this longitudinal mode completely decouples from the remaining degrees of freedom, and you actually get an agreement with the predictions of general relativity. Okay, so now what happens in massive Young-Mills theory? Well, in fact, the same thing. So you can consult this paper over here. That in fact, the longitudinal modes of massive Young-Mills theory also enter a strong coupling regime and decoupled from the transverse modes for the scale beyond the strong coupling scale, okay? Which is equivalent of the Weinstein scale. And basically there you recover the massless Young-Mills theory. Now, okay, so this is the question of massless limits, sorry. But what does it have to do with dualities? So let's now look at the following two theories. So first theory, which we are going to consider, is a Proca theory. So this is a theory of a massive vector field where over here the mass is again added by hand. Okay? So it's simply theory of a spin one field, which is massive. Very good. So now let's compare it to another theory. So this over here is now the Kalman-Ramon theory. Okay, so over here is the kinetic term, which is the analogous of the field strength, which we have, for instance, in Proca. B mu is the so-called Kalman-Ramon field over here, and you see that it is now an antisymmetric two form. Okay? So now on the first side, these two theories do not seem same at all, right? One is a theory of a spin one, the other one is a theory of a two form. However, there were numerous claims in the literature that these theories are dual. So, what does this mean? So, this means that they basically have the same physics. Okay? So, entirely the same physics. And why is it the case? Well, first of all, both theories have the same number of degrees of freedom. So, Proca theory and Kalman-Ramon both have one longitudinal mode and two transverse modes. And moreover, they are connected with the so-called dualization procedure, the procedure where you can connect both of these actions of the theories, okay? However, my goal is to convince you, in fact, that these two theories do not have the same physics, okay? And the way I'm going to do this is by analyzing the massless limit of the interacting theories. So, let's begin. So, first of all, I'm going to compare the following two theories. I'm going to take a Proca theory, and I'm going to modify it by adding to it a quadric self-interaction. And I'm going to also do the same thing to the Kalman-Ramon theory, okay? So over here, I'm going to add now B mu squared term. And then simply study the two theories and see if they have actually the same physics or no, okay? So how will I do this? So first of all, I'm going to basically express my theory just in terms of the propagating degrees of freedom, the longitudinal modes and the two transverse modes, okay? And after this, there's gonna be some certain strong coupling scale in the theory where the perturbation theory will break down. And after this, I'm simply gonna estimate the theory beyond the strong coupling scale, okay? So let's start then with Proca theory. So we have now our standard action, and what I'm now gonna do is I'm gonna decompose my field, the spatial part of the vector field, into the transverse modes and the longitudinal mode. So this AIT over here are the transverse modes, chi is the longitudinal mode. And then once you do this, you find the following action. Ah, but now you can see, okay, A0 component over here is not propagating. Why? Because it does not have any time derivatives acting on it. So rather it satisfies a constraint. So, since I don't like A0 having in my Lagrangian, I'm simply going to integrate it out. In other words, I'm going to find the constraint it satisfies and resolve it and plug it back into the Lagrangian. And then you basically obtain an infinite number of terms. However, luckily, all of them are not equally relevant. So, what you obtain, the most important part, is the kinetic term for the longitudinal modes, the kinetic term for the transverse modes, and certain interactions over here. Okay, so now first of all, you can notice that the longitudinal modes are not canonically normalized. First of all, they have this m squared over here multiplying them, and also they have over here this minus Laplacian over minus Laplacian plus m squared. So simply define a canonical normalization variable in this following way. Okay, and, So then what you obtain basically is this Lagrangian. So now you can see the following, which is important. Okay, so you can notice that now the interactions over here are multiplied with 1 over mass to the 4. And in particular, you can notice that the more longitudinal modes the interaction has, then it becomes more problematic if I take the massless limit, right? I mean, it's obvious over here, right? You have the longitudinal modes to the power of 4, yeah? And it's multiplied by 1 over mass to the 4. Over here, you have 3 of them, and you have still 1 over m cubed. Okay, but still, I want to compare my terms to be sure, okay? And the way I do this is through the minimal level of quantum fluctuations. So basically, what are these? So you can, for instance, take a scalar field. Okay. Are there, by the way, if there are any questions, you can simply ask. It's not a problem. Okay. Yeah, so you take a scalar field, okay? And now when you quantize this scalar field, then basically in the state of its minimal energy, so the Gradient state, this field is not gonna be stationary, okay? It's still gonna fluctuate a little bit. And these are the minimal level of quantum fluctuations, which are given by the two-point correlation function over here. So you can show basically that for a standard scalar field, when you do standard canonical quantization, that you will obtain that for the length scales, L, okay, which are proportional to the 1 over the energy of the field, they're simply going to be given by 1 over L. And now you can simply take this and apply the same logic over here to also Broca theory. And then you will find that the transverse modes are simply 1 over L, the longitudinal modes are 1 over L, and then you can also infer the original modes, which are going to be 1 over mass multiplied by L. And then you use this, and then you use it to compare the terms, and you will find that the most important terms in your Broca theory are simply the kinetic term for the longitudinal modes and the nonlinear interaction over here. Okay? So, now, what is happening? So, now, I simply develop my perturbation theory over here, and I can notice over here that my perturbation is gonna break down when this nonlinear term becomes of the same order as the kinetic term. And this corresponds to this strong coupling scale over here. So then basically this means that if I'm on the length scales larger than the strong coupling scale, I can still apply my perturbation theory. However, once I reach it, then it's done, okay? Then it breaks down. And the question is now what happens beyond it? So one can do this, and the way to do it is simply to find what is the most important term for the longitudinal modes once this, what's the most important term for the longitudinal modes once you break, once you go beyond the strong coupling scale. And this is basically this interacting term, which at the beginning even caused the strong coupling. And you can then use it to find the value of the longitudinal mode, and you will simply find that it is 1 over square root of the coupling constant. However, there is also one more cool thing. Well, the perturbation theory breaks down only in the longitudinal modes, but for the transverse mode, you can still use it. And therefore, you can use it also to find what are the corrections to the transverse modes due to the longitudinal ones. And you find simply that they are given by this over here. So for instance, in perturbation theory, it seemed that you have like 1 over mass contributions. However, now these corrections actually become very, very small. So then we have the following situation in Broca theory. So if you take the longitudinal mode, which is original, then basically for the length scales, which are above the strong coupling scale, where you can use the perturbation theory, you have simply that it is following simply like 1 over mass multiplied by the length scale. Then, after it enters the strong coupling, then it kind of freezes, and basically becomes of order of 1 over square root of the coupling constant. On the other hand, the transverse modes are nice, yeah? So they are simply 1 over L, and then beyond the strong coupling, they get a little bit corrected. Okay, so now let's look at the other theory. So now I want to take this theory and compare it to Kalbra-Mond. So for this, I use literally the same logic, okay? So I'm again gonna decompose my theory just in terms of the transverse modes and the longitudinal ones. And there, in contrast to Proca, I have two constraints. But okay, you can still resolve them, and then in the end find the following action. So now, you can notice that over here my transverse modes, which are given by BIT, are not canonically normalized. And over here, phi, are now the longitudinal modes. So simply now, what you can do again is you canonically normalize the variables, and also do the same thing also for the non-linear terms. And then, okay, so you can find again the minimal level of quantum fluctuations, use it to compare these terms, and basically find when your perturbation theory breaks down. So now this happens in the Kalbra-Mond theory, in contrast to the Proca one, due to the transverse modes. Now we're here, now you have this following interaction, which is now given by the transverse modes to the power of 4, okay? So if you now compare it with the linear term, then you will find the same strong coupling scale as we had in the Proca theory. However, now a different type of degree of freedom gets strongly coupled. So now you will find actually that the transverse modes enter the strong coupling regime. And then again, you can wonder, okay, what now beyond this strong coupling scale? Well, there you can simply find that now the transverse modes are proportional to 1 over the square root of the coupling constant, and also estimate the corrections for the longitudinal modes. So the situation then looks like the following. So now, basically in the perturbation theory, you have that instead of the longitudinal modes, the transverse modes are now proportional to 1 over mass multiplied by length. Then at some point, they enter the strong coupling regime and then become most simply 1 over square root of g. On the other hand, now the longitudinal modes are fine. The perturbation theory for them is fine constantly, okay? And you can simply find that beyond the strong coupling scale, they get a little bit corrected. Okay, so then let's simply now compare our theories. So we have found that in both of them, the same Weinstein scale appears, okay? So the scale where when the perturbation theory breaks down. It's given simply by the square root of the coupling constant over the mass. If we are now above the strong coupling scale, then the divergences in Proca theory are due to the longitudinal modes, while on the other hand, in Kalbra-Mond, we had that the divergences are due to the transverse modes. Okay, so it's a little bit different. On the other hand, if we are now at the strong coupling scale, in one theory, the longitudinal modes enter the strong coupling regime, while in the other one, the transverse modes enter the strong coupling regime. And moreover, when we go beyond, basically, we recover in Proca theory, just simply Maxwell theory, up to very, very small corrections. While on the other hand, in Kalbra-Mond theory, we simply obtain a theory of a massless Kalbra-Mond field up to these very, very small corrections. So, to put it all together, we can notice that the transverse modes of one theory behave as the longitudinal modes of the other one, and vice versa. So, to me, this honestly does not seem like the theories then can have simply the same physics. And with that, I would like to conclude my talk, and I'm open to the questions. Okay, so, thank you.
So, any questions? Yes, Guylaine.
You said in the beginning that people consider or they claim that the two theories are equivalent. And what does support this equivalence? Because it reminds me of the idea that for closed strings, you have these Kalbra-Mond excitations, and mm-hmm. open string, you have this vector excitation. So does it come from there? Or?
No, so basically, like they claim that the two theories have the same physics because they both have the same number of degrees of freedom, you see? So the transverse modes and the longitudinal modes. So this is the claim. Okay.
name, and institution.
Gerard and Ahmed at Utrecht. It looks as if the relationships you talk about have some degree of non-locality, because you have your Laplacian hanging around everywhere at some point.
Ah, yeah, so you've got this actually because you just integrated out the constraints. So for instance, in Proca theory, the A0 component is not propagating. This is actually similar like in Young-Mills theory, for instance. There also you will have that the A0 is not propagating at all. You see?
So but sometimes it's profitable to enhance the number of degrees of freedom which may hang together with local field equations. But that way you can exchange nonlinearity with number of degrees of freedom. And that then shows where things become non-local, because now you have a Laplace equation, Laplace operator linking one operator to another, one field to another field. You know, I couldn't follow
but
all the details
about this. Here, okay, I'm not quite sure that I actually understand. So you say that because the theory is that the description is non-local, that you might have actually that the different degrees of freedom mapping to each other. Is that your claim?
I would just be tempted to say, well, if you have equations like this, I like to tear them apart and take and use as many variables as I need to get a very simple linear or local differential equations, which I can understand, you know, how one variable affects the other variables.
Uh-huh.
And then you can later you can try to solve as much as you can and put it all together, but then you get a rather difficult decipherable knot of equations, which it looks a little bit like going in that direction. So I think also you get a unique description when you disentangle all the degrees of freedom as much as you can.
But this, in this particular description, you literally do disentangle. So it's actually very similar to cosmological perturbation theory, where you're also analyzing, for instance, the fluctuations of the scalar fields of your vector fields and of also the tensor fluctuations, which are in the gravitational waves. So here, I basically do the same procedure for both of the theories. However, the main point over here is that different number of degrees of freedom are always going to get strongly coupled in different theories. So already this is like a strong indicator, because for me, for instance, over here I see in Proca theory, the two transverse modes are not strongly coupled. Okay, they're always, you can always develop the perturbation theory for them. On the other hand, the longitudinal mode is strongly coupled. Now this is 1 degree of freedom. And now I can simply take it and compare it to the Kalpermann theory. And there I have exactly the opposite situation, but it's not like one transverse mode is strongly coupled, but there are actually 2 degrees of freedom that are actually entering the strong coupling regime, you see?
But you could compare that with gravity, where you have simply matter added to it. Matter which obeys its own matter equations. So in that way, of course, you see also the number of degrees of freedom will change because there are matter fields around.
Mm-hmm.
Which also represent
yes, because matter can also source the fields, absolutely. But here, so you can simply take the simplest, I don't know.
Okay,
no, but here, I mean, you have the nonlinear interaction, so you are actually having all 10 degrees of freedom in the game. I actually did not quite catch the argument there. Sorry.
Thank you.
We are running late. So I think we should conclude the question session and you do your talk.
Okay.
So thanks very much again.
Thank you.
And we reconvene in 10 minutes, all right?
So, yep.
That's right.